Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Michael Taylor, the curator of Marcel Duchamp, Etant Donné, which opens at the Philadelphia Museum of Art today. Susan Lewis takes us to an exhibition at the National Constitution Center, exploring the ways American architects are using recycled materials to address social issues. And Jason Pfeiffer explores Philadelphia's Swedish origins with a visit to the American Swedish Historical Museum. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
For the past 40 years, tucked away in an unlit hallway at the back of a far-flung gallery in the Philadelphia Museum of Art, has stood an old Spanish wooden door with what appear to be two peepholes. The peepholes in the wooden door give the visitor a partial view of a nude female mannequin spread-eagled on a bed of twigs, holding a gas lamp in the air. In the background, an illuminated motorized waterfall is the centerpiece of a beautifully rendered mural of a Swiss mountain vista. This is how one encounters Etant Donné, the final work of Marcel Duchamp, one of the 20th century's most enigmatic and at times controversial artists. In the summer of 1969, the Philadelphia Museum of Art unveiled what would become a highly controversial new installation by the then recently deceased Marcel Duchamp. Its existence came as a surprise to many in the art world, because it had long been assumed that he had given up art to become a world-class chess player 20 years before. Duchamp's most famous works include the 1912 painting Nude Descending a Staircase No. 2, the bride stripped bare by her bachelors even, the large glass, famously declared completed by the artist only after it was accidentally damaged, as well as several infamous ready-mades, commonplace commercially produced items like fountain, a toilet urinal, and bicycle wheel, a bicycle fork and front wheel mounted upside down on a wooden stool. Today, these works, all in Philadelphia, continue to provoke strong reactions from museum visitors, something that would have pleased Duchamp, who coined the term anti-art, as he believed that objects became art not in their creation, but at the moment of their viewing. To celebrate the 40th anniversary of the installation of Etant Donné, the Philadelphia Museum of Art today opens an exhibition consisting of Duchamp's extraordinary tableau, along with close to 80 related works. The new exhibition is curated by Michael Taylor, the Philadelphia Museum of Art's curator of modern art. On any given day, if you stand near the Duchamp exhibits here, you will get a variety of responses, everything varying from surprise to disgust and emotions to the left and right of those. How are we supposed to approach this man? Decades after he was at his most creative, a lot of people don't really get what we're supposed to get.
Well, I think one of the problems with Duchamp is we always forget his sense of humor. And, I mean, I think his reputation now is as the father of conceptual art. And so people expect him to be dry and intellectual. But in fact, he always saw his work as being hilariously funny. And I think if you go into it with that attitude, you start to see things differently. He also was not pretentious in any way. In fact, he hated the Parisian avant-garde for that very reason.
So when you hear, particularly in front of the fountain, why is this art? And the other comment is, well, if you wanted to create anti-art, why isn't it exhibited in an anti-art gallery?
We don't have an anti-art gallery. Maybe we should. That's a good idea. I think also the thing to remember about Duchamp is that one of the great misconceptions, and remember, my family is as guilty of this as anyone. They certainly had that same reaction. It's like Duchamp just signed things and that was his idea of a work of art. And so always the suggestion is there's no skill there. And of course, it's a different mindset. And it is this conceptual tradition that I was talking about. But one of the things that Duchamp was always clear on is you have to go and see his work in one place, and that place is the Philadelphia Museum. And the reason he liked that was that we show his Impressionist paintings, his Cubist paintings, so you see his development. And these ideas don't come out of nowhere. There's a long gestation period. So to get to Fountain, which is, as you know, it's a public men's room urinal that he took out and he signed, to get to that took him two decades of really studying and being an artist, but rejecting tradition. And that was always the crux for him, I think, was he didn't want to repeat the past. He wanted to make something that was shocking. I mean, there's no doubt about it that shock is built into that work. But he also wanted to break the codes and traditions of painting. And that's what any serious artist, you know, if you think back to Rembrandt, Michelangelo, Raphael, all of these artists, the reason we know them today is they did something new and an original. And so Duchamp is in that tradition, whether he likes it or not.
But he did also, as is clearly exhibited by this latest exhibition, have the craft skills. He had the actual artistic tools to be able to create whatever he could envision, whatever he thought of, he could create it with his hands. That's well exhibited in this show.
Well, I think that's exactly true, and it's going to come as a surprise to people because a lot of the works on display have never been shown before or published before. But this last work that he made, which was called Étant donné, which means given the waterfall and the illuminating gas, it's a site-specific museum installation designed for the gallery that it's in now at the Philadelphia Museum. That work he worked on for 20 years, and the studies that he made, the sort of grueling kind of thinking that went behind the work, it really challenged him because he had given up art. He had sort of stopped painting. He'd made those ready-made. And then at a certain point, he started playing chess very seriously. He represented France at the Olympics. And there was a long period where people thought, that's it. No more art for Duchamp. But what we now know is from 1946 to 1966, he was hard at work on this project. And many of the studies are remarkable in their illusionism, in their technique, in the use of color. We never associate color with Duchamp, but it's like he becomes an impressionist painter at the end of his life. And I love that because he also embraced contradiction. And so for everyone who thinks that Duchamp is this note-making, diagram-drawing Leonardo-like genius,
which he is also,
there is this other Duchamp, which is very sensual. It's about the materials, the craft. He was building a three-dimensional life-size diorama with a nude in a landscape, and he had to go back to his earliest training to pull that off.
Even in terms of things like the mural, which is a great piece of classical painting.
Yeah, absolutely. And so In a very good way, I think, so unexpected, because just when you think you know this artist, and I've studied him now for 20 years, just when you think you know everything about him, that surprised me. He had to make a painted backdrop. It is like a mural. It fills the whole wall of the back of the piece. And he didn't quite know how to do it when he began. And he begins with very small-scale photographs of a waterfall in Switzerland. And he cuts up these black and white photographs and makes a collage, quite large, but not huge. And he inserts the nude in it, and, you know, that's sort of maybe a book size. And then he realizes in 1954, when he has to install the large glass here, he gets the dimensions of the gallery that it's going to go in. And it's from there he realizes that he has to build a big backdrop. And what he does is that we now know is he works with Salvador Dali, who helps him make these collar-type prints, and it's those that he will hand-paint in the final version. So again, we're talking about a decade-long process as he's figuring out how to make that diorama background. And if you look at it now, it is absolutely a sort of masterpiece of painting. I mean, if you took out the nude and just hung that somewhere, it really is something that just takes your breath away. It's got that mist from the lake. There's beautiful wood colors. It's sort of blazing autumn, really. And I think that you sort of always forget that with Duchamp, that he was capable of that.
Talk us through the sequence of events that led to the installation in what was to always have been its home here at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Duchamp dies in
68.
And is anybody in this building aware of the existence of this work prior to then?
There were some people. Duchamp finishes the piece in 1966. And then I think there's a moment of anxiety for him. What if the museum says no? I mean, he's been counting on the museum saying yes and taking this piece, but it does deal with sex in a kind of shockingly frank way, if you like to see it that way. And he knew...
And voyeurism and all kinds
and
of other issues.
Yeah. There were certainly enough issues. And remember, this is now more than 40 years ago. There were issues that he knew that could be raised by a board of trustees. And he reached out. He invited Bonnie Winterstein, a very important patron of the museum, one-time president, to come and see the work. And she didn't find it shocking at all. And I think that delighted him. And he also worked with his friend Bill Copley, who was the heir to the Copley Press, that chain of newspapers. So he was financially wealthy. And he actually bought the piece from Duchamp, set up a foundation called the Cassandra Foundation, with the express view of giving it to the museum after Duchamp died. But what was brilliant about that plan was that it paid for the insurance, the transportation, the installation itself, the catalogue, the press. So anything that the museum could have said, oh, we would love this piece, but of course we can't afford to bring it here, or we'd love that piece, but
that
of course the insurance
with.
Is going to be too high. So it was wonderful because it really sort of, I think Duchamp thought of any quibble that could have been raised, and Copley provided the money to take care of it. So Duchamp died peacefully because he knew that this was going to happen.
So it gets installed here, and the public are made aware of it. What's the reaction in 1969 when this installation is unveiled?
Well, it was quite a scene. The museum tripled its attendance that year. There were a lot of protests. There were a lot of people who thought that it was shocking and pornographic. One newspaper headline said, "A pornographic howl," which of course is a reference to Allen Ginsberg, and so it was very much tied into that. And there had been issues of censorship in Philadelphia at that time, and I found it interesting that just before Etant Donnée is unveiled, in Fairmount Park, there's a play performed called Scuba Duba, in which a white woman kisses an African-American man on stage. And it was actually broken up. It was an open-air performance, and it was broken up by the police. So, you know, that sort of gives you a little bit of the sense of what the censorship was going on. But in fact, most people loved it. They came back again and again. And as I said, we tripled our attendance that year. And it really spoke to artists. And I think that's one of the great things of this exhibition, is to highlight the fact that there were younger artists like Robert Gober and Ray Johnson who really saw something very new in Duchamp. Hannah Wilke is another one. And Etant Donnée, as I said, it gave another facet to him that reached out to another area of artists, not just the conceptual artists who had adored him, but also artists who in their own work were dealing with issues of voyeurism, of realism. So I think it was a huge success. It was very carefully managed by the museum. And in doing the research, I spoke to the director of that time, Evan Turner, and he really did have a game plan. He had assembled a group of prominent cultural leaders. So if anyone said, "This is outrageous, close down the museum," he had a whole committee of people who would turn around and say, "No, it's important for the history of art, and here's why." And they were led by someone like Richard Brilliant, who was at Penn, teaching art history, who would sort of compare it to Roman grottos, you know. So there was always an effort by the museum to place it in some sort of context. Now, I went through all the complaints, and there were many. There were many complaints. But a lot of them had to do with the queues, the height of the peepholes. One woman wrote in and said she walked all the way from South Philadelphia and then was shocked and amazed that because she was 4 feet tall, she couldn't see it. So I just think she should have asked the person behind her to lift her up, you know. And eventually, I think the museum did provide some sort of stools or something to stand up on.
This new exhibition is dedicated to the late Anne Darnancourt, the Philadelphia Museum of Art's much-loved director who died last year. As a 25-year-old curatorial assistant, she was sent to the artist's studio in New York to organize the move and installation of Etant Donnée back in Philadelphia. Michael Taylor says that of all the tributes paid to Anne Darnancourt, this is for him the most poignant.
Her legacy is an important one and an enduring one, and I certainly felt her on my shoulders as I was installing and writing the book. And I think that, you know, that piece really changed her life. not many people know this, but she was really a Pre-Raphaelite scholar before she was given this assignment to go to New York and work with the family on the piece. And it changed her life. She goes on to do the definitive Duchamp retrospective in 1973 and remained throughout the rest of her life the preeminent Duchamp scholar of her generation. And so it shows you how chance can play a factor in these things. And certainly I learned a great deal from her. She was a great mentor. So this exhibition is dedicated to her memory.
Michael Taylor, the Muriel and Philip Berman Curator of Modern Art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Marcel Duchamp, Etant Donné, opens today and runs through November 29th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Enduring works of architecture can be cultural monuments, from the Great Pyramids of Egypt to the Taj Mahal, from majestic Gothic cathedrals to sleek urban skyscrapers. But as civilization has evolved, so has the field of architecture and its purposes. A new exhibition in Philadelphia is demonstrating how American architects are reusing materials and space to address social needs. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers these changing ideas about architectural possibilities in Into the Open.
Around Philadelphia's Independence Mall are many examples of the evolution of American architecture, from modest 18th century Georgian houses to contemporary structures that house the Visitor Center and the National Constitution Center. But this summer, architecture of another sort is being explored in Into the Open, an exhibition of the work of over a dozen architectural groups, displays of which are divided between the Slott Foundation, an organization that fosters artistic collaboration, and the National Constitution Center, where Linda Johnson is president and CEO. Johnson says the show taps into the idea of citizenship and responsibility for making the community better. In this case, through architecture.
It's not necessarily architecture in the traditional sense of, you know, building buildings, but rather how buildings can have an impact on the community and how spaces can act in a way to coalesce communities.
The theory is that some social problems can be solved with a creative use of space, and some architects are doing just that. This observation led to the creation of this exhibition, which was chosen to represent the U.S. at last year's Venice Architectural Biennale. U.S. State Department's Cultural Programs Division Chief, Columbia Barras, acknowledges that this is an unusual show.
But that is what made it such an excellent showcase for us at the 11th Architecture Biennale in Venice, because it really provided a lot of insight into our society.
Insight into the way our society is approaching problems that are common throughout the world. Poverty, crime, environmental issues, and diminishing resources. Project co-curator William Menking, executive editor of The Architect's Newspaper, says these solutions are developing from the ground up.
In a dialogue with the architect and those who are going to be served by the buildings or the plans or whatever it is that the project is creating.
The exhibits include images and models documenting a range of structures and designs. $20,000 houses were built for a rural community in Alabama. A swimming pool was refashioned from an abandoned barge that architect Jonathan Kirschenfeld found in New Orleans.
And he turned this thing into a big bathtub, a huge swimming pool that had to be pulled up on a tug, it has no motor, from New Orleans. And then it's floated around the New York City waterfront for the summertime for kids to swim in.
Another example of how existing space and materials can be redefined is a temporary band shell created in a San Francisco park. Exhibition co-curator Aaron Levy is executive director and senior curator at the Slott Foundation.
They took 65 car hoods, they took over 1,000 plastic bottles, they took some computer parts, and they built a theatrical space for the public. And for the short time that it was on display, they redefined how that public space was used, how that public park could be used.
The exhibition itself has been repurposed to fit a new audience. Levy says at the Biennale,
we were highlighting in Venice, 16 sites of conflict, 16 sites of socioeconomic disparity, environmental difficulty, and then highlighting how architects are mitigating the severity of those situations. And here we're trying to do something a little bit different. In Philadelphia, we're trying to address, in a certain sense, the future of the city.
Levy says that since 1950, Philadelphia has lost nearly 500,000 residents, leaving multiple abandoned buildings and empty lots. The models in this show, he says, could offer ideas to mitigate some of these social ills. No one project attempts to define what architecture is or should be, he says, but together they illustrate a variety of possibilities.
And we're trying to go beyond building, so to speak, and define a building not just as a physical infrastructure, but also as a social relationship with a community.
Some displays visually depict social relationships like Damon Rich's The Subsidized Landscape, an interactive model with miniature housing in government buildings connected by strings of lights to show how housing is financed by various government agencies. Rich, the founder of the Center for Urban Pedagogy, says architecture is too often viewed as a luxury for the rich.
But what I was really happy about this show is I think it takes really seriously the notion that design can be more than just a niche consumer good, and that design can really offer a whole set of tools for starting discussions around how we allocate our resources as a society.
And starting discussions is what this exhibition aims to do. National Constitution Center President Linda Johnson hopes it will prod the curious and prompt dialogue.
It is really about civic engagement, about what it means to be a citizen and take responsibility for making your community a better place.
Civic engagement has been a vital part of this nation since its founding. And William Menking says this kind of thinking about architecture is not as new as it may seem.
We didn't think of this as an historical exhibit when we began. We thought of it as a kind of contemporary issue. But then in thinking about it and trying to explain in different venues, we realized it's part of a longer dialogue, I would say, that probably started at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, when architecture began to engage with planning issues, for example, in the cities.
But still, floating pools and band shells from car hoods? It's not your father's architecture, or even your great-great-grandfather's architecture. But it is emblematic of the American will, taking architectural skills and a pioneering spirit to conquer the wilderness of the 21st century urban landscape.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Into the Open is at the National Constitution Center on Independence Mall and the Slott Foundation in West Philadelphia through September 7th. The Patterson Avenue section of South Philadelphia is best known as the home of the city's sports stadiums, great hulking structures representing a popular part of the city's identity and recent history. Yet in the shadow of these sporting venues is an institution that explores a culture that helped shape the very existence of Philadelphia and the surrounding region. Built in 1926 and nestled in Franklin D. Roosevelt Park, the American Swedish Historical Museum is the oldest Swedish museum in the country, and as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now reports, it today continues to offer reminders of a strong Swedish influence in the Delaware Valley.
Traces of Philadelphia's Swedish heritage are easy to find. Take a close look at the city seal, or flag of Philadelphia, with its three vertical stripes of blue, gold, and blue again. It bears a strong resemblance to Sweden's blue flag with its large gold cross. And this isn't mere coincidence, according to the Swedish Historical Museum's executive director, Tracy Beck.
That is all based on the fact that the Swedes were the first Western settlers in this area, and so their colors were sort of embraced by the state and the cities around here.
Decades before William Penn and his fellow Quakers arrived, a small group of Swedish settlers came to the region in 1638, forming the New Sweden Colony along the banks of the Delaware River in modern-day Delaware, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. Kim Erik Williams, honorary governor of the Swedish Colonial Society and director of the Swedish Language Program at the University of Pennsylvania, says with the support of Sweden's King Gustav Adolphus, the motivation to start a settlement in the New World was simple.
The idea was to come, establish a fort, and then trade with the Indians, get enough furs that you possibly could, take them back to Europe and make money. And the only settlements you had would be a couple farms around the fort which were necessary for food for the soldiers to keep the place going.
Williams says New Sweden was small and never really prosperous. By 1655, it was taken over by the Dutch, who had another colony along the Hudson River, then known as New Amsterdam, and now, well, you know. Yet many of the Swedish settlers remained in the Delaware Valley, and still more Swedes continued to emigrate and make a new life in the New World. By the 1690s, there were about 1,200 Swedish-speaking people living in the Delaware Valley. The early Swedish presence in colonial America is illustrated in the grand lobby of the American Swedish Historical Museum. The towering ceiling displays a colorful mural depicting the first Swedish settlers interacting with Native Americans. Compared to other colonial powers like the Dutch and English, the Scandinavian settlers actually got along pretty well with the Native Americans, according to the museum's curator, Kerry Hogan. In many ways, by necessity.
The Swedes were very judicious. They were always outnumbered in so many respects. So they played it safe. They traded very carefully. They were nonviolent.
An examination of the relationship between the Swedes and Native Americans is part of a current exhibition at the American Swedish Historical Museum called Colony to Community, The Story of New Sweden. The show was organized in conjunction with this year's 100th anniversary for the Swedish Colonial Society, another organization created by the museum's founder, Amandus Johnson, designed to preserve the legacy of the New Sweden colony in America through research and publications. The Colony to Community exhibit includes Native American artifacts, a watercolor portrait of a New Sweden governor by N.C. Wyeth, a Swedish coin from 1645, and a variety of church artifacts.
We have here the Geneva Bible from 1599 that William Penn gave to Gloria Day Church in Philadelphia.
Carrie Hogan also points out silver communionware on loan from the Holy Trinity Old Swedes Church in Wilmington, Delaware. Precious items from Sweden given to the church in the early 1700s and still used today. Hogan says such objects represent the central role that churches played in sustaining Swedish culture in the region up until a period of mass immigration from Sweden to America in the 1800s.
And really what we're doing with this section of the church items is bridging the New Sweden colony to today. Without the church community, we really wouldn't have a whole lot of continuity into the 19th century that we would see with when immigration occurred. There would be no infrastructure of Swedish community here had these churches not sustained this population with language and culture and food.
There are 24 historic Swedish sites still preserved in Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey, and Maryland. They consist of 8 old Swedes churches, parks, a full-scale replica ship, and historic log cabins, another part of New Sweden's legacy. Kim Eric Williams says many of the first Swedish settlers came from heavily forested areas and helped introduce log cabin construction to America.
3 Swedish settlers, 3 men, could build a log cabin in a day. And that log cabin was good for 60 years. They were expert woodsmen. And this was a perfect sort of place to live in a country like America, which was filled with forests.
Along with examining the Swedish influence in America, Executive Director Tracy Beck says the Swedish Historical Museum also takes a look back at life in Sweden.
This is the stuga, which is a representation of what a one-room house in Sweden might have looked like. And so we have the corner fireplace that is typical of a Swedish home.
The Swedish Historical Museum houses 12 permanent galleries, including the stuga with its intricately stenciled ceilings and walls. There's a room that envelops visitors with a map of 17th century Sweden, painted on walls covered with bronze leaf, while another gallery is dedicated to the Nobel Prizes, founded by Swedish inventor and entrepreneur Alfred Nobel. Each year, the museum also hosts a midsummer celebration, a major summer solstice holiday in Sweden. It usually involves raising a maypole around which to dance and sing traditional songs. Kim Eric Williams says the holiday is all about daylight, something the Swedes don't always see a lot of during the harsh winters.
In December, you're getting 2 or 3 hours of light. But by the official midsummer, you have 24 hours of light rather than almost 24 hours of darkness. And so this certainly does call for a celebration.
William says in the U.S. today, descendants of the New Sweden colony number between 20 and 30 million. Many are unaware of their Swedish roots because it's well over 10 generations back. Yet through passionate leaders, historic churches, scholarly research, and institutions like the American Swedish Historical Museum, the influential legacy of this first European colony in the Delaware Valley will not soon be forgotten.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.